Chair must pay to a board edit, my Maynard, much away from Lumia to any Māori order. We begin by remembering the piece of scripture that in the whatever the Tauratoa wrote on the rules of engagement in 1864 from the Apostle Paul, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If they are thirsty, give them drink. And it is the saying that applies to this place. So I always use that whenever I start to address people. So welcome to you all. Welcome to the Whakarakia or Hori Tapu, Church of St. George. It's great to have a good number here again tonight. Last week we had a wonderful session with Cliff about the Battle of Hukihinehine. And tonight we hear about the Battle of Taranga, which is not often talked about. It's often just kind of snuck in on the end of the talks about the Hinehine. I know I just kind of do a little 5 minutes whenever I do my presentation to school. So it's good to have a whole session about that tonight. It's wonderful we have Cliff here. Buddy is also going to talk about the New Zealand Land Wars Museum. I have a piece of paper in front of me with its correct name, which is going to go across the road. If anyone knows where there's a spare 55 million, just see Buddy at the end of the session, we'd like to hear from you. So it's great to have a good number here again tonight. So I invite you to welcome Cliff as he begins the session.
And good evening, welcome. I see a few faces that look familiar from last week, so I'm glad to see you back, and other people as well, you're very welcome. So I'm Cliff Simons. I'm a military historian. I've been studying these wars for about 35 years, and teaching about them and writing about them. I'm also an army officer, so I've looked at them from a military perspective. And for the last 10 years or so, it was my pleasure to be able to go around these battlefields and take groups of New Zealand military personnel and other groups and walk around the battlefields and learn stories. So that's briefly my background. Buddy and I have worked together on numerous projects. We're both trustees of the museum that he's going to talk about later on. He's the project director. And we wrote the book together, Victory at Gate Park. And he'll tell you a little bit about that later. It's actually just about to be reissued or republished. So I'm going to talk for about an hour about the Battle of Taranga. Given my background, I'm going to sort of have a fairly military-heavy sort of emphasis on the way that the battle went. But I hope to give you an overview of how the battle, why the battle took place, what happened, and then the aftermath of that. I've called it an overlooked battle. I was trying to find the right word, and I spent quite a lot of time looking at synonyms to try and find a word. I'm not completely happy with overlooked, but it is a battle that is not talked about very much. And as John said, you know, we often just tag it on at the end of other of talks about the Gate Park. Is the thing that had a picture on?
Johnson.
Oh, there it is. Thanks. So, Taranga is a battle that isn't well known. It's not as well known as this one, and I can't really tell you why. It's not as well known as the battle here at Gate Park. In terms of the New Zealand Wars, it had one of the highest death tolls of any of those colonial battles that took place during the New Zealand Wars period. Around about 170 people were killed in this in the Battle of Taranga. So it's up at a level similar to the Battle of Arauca. Those death tolls are a lot lower than the battles of the Musket Wars. For instance, the Battle of Otamataha down here in the 1820s was over 600 people, and there are a lot of places around the country where there were more than 1,000 deaths. But for the 1860s period, this was one of the big battles in terms of death toll. It's a controversial battle, and I must say to you, I feel slightly uneasy talking about it because there are allegations that it was a massacre and sort of deception and things like that, so I'll cover some of that later. And it's also the last battle, if we think of the Waikato War spilling into Tauranga, it's the last battle in that series. So the Waikato War started in 1863, and this was 12 or 13 months later, and this brought that whole period to an end. So I'm going to go through very quickly some of what I talked about last week for those who weren't here. So you can see that by early 1864, the fighting in the Waikato had gotten to an area around Te Awamutu. This is in about January 1864, and that's actually very close to Tauranga. And Tauranga was an area where war supplies were being landed and taken over the Kaimais to the Maori army that was in the Waikato. And also men were coming through from the east coast, and they were crossing over from Tauranga into the Waikato. And some people actually gave Tauranga the name of the Port of Waikato. But I want to just emphasise to you, before we really get started, that war here in Tauranga did not start because of any problems that were developing here. If we look at Wellington or New Plymouth and the Taranaki War, they grew out of arguments over land and what land had been purchased and things like that. There was none of that here. In general, the populations, the Maori and Pākehā populations in Tauranga, got on reasonably well. So it didn't grow out of tensions. In a way, the war came over the Kaimais and came to here. The Maori population, it's hard to know. I've said up to several thousand. I think probably 2,000 to 3,000. And three major iwi. This is a picture that was painted by Robley in 1865. So this is the year after the battles, and this is Matapihi. The Pākehā population was actually very small, probably about 50 people. Mainly the mission station, or several mission families, but there was also there were some traders and some farmers. And of course, I must remember to mention that there was the Roman Catholic mission at the Otumaita Whai. Now, the key European personality, or Pākehā personality, was Archdeacon Brown, who had been here for a long time. He had been here about 25 years at this stage, and had established a very successful mission station. He had actually been in New Zealand since 1827, so he had been here for all of his adult life. Now, why did the government take an interest in Tauranga? Well, some of the warriors from here had been involved in the fighting in Waikato since Merimeri in the late 1863. And at the moment, they were, just before the troops arrived here, they were in the near the Cambridge area, preparing to defend a power in that area near Maumatauteri, because the British were then coming up the Waikato River. So the government knew that some of the people here were supporters of Kingitanga and were fighting in the Waikato, and they knew that it was a harbour or a port for war supplies, and they knew, we'll use the word logistics, they knew it was part of the logistics system. They knew that there was a lot of food being grown here, and that was about to be taken over into the Waikato, and they knew that a lot of men had said that when the harvest was taken in, they would go across. And so, as well as arriving here and trying to stop that, they also wanted to give the local people here something to think about. If the troops arrived here, it's going to take their mind off going across and joining the war in Waikato. And so, in January the 21st, 1864, warships came through the heads, troops jumped off, took over the vicinity of what we now know as the Owens, or the mission station, and set up a blockade of the harbour to stop all of those activities. And over the next few months, there were a number of battles that took place. The first one was in the Rotorua Lakes, in this area here. Quite a large war party from the east coast, from the Kairapiti, were coming through, and they wanted to cut through the Rotorua Lakes area and get to Waikato. And they asked permission from Te Arawa, and Arawa were aligned to the Crown, so they were supporters of the government. Perhaps another way of phrasing that is that their aims coincided with the government's aims, and so it was a useful coalition. And they denied them access. The war party tried to get through, and there was a running battle here in March, April, in this area here. They were driven back to the coast, and then the British and the Te Arawa developed a very strong redoubt here at Makatu. Eventually, the East Coast Iwi attacked that redoubt, and there was a battle along this beach here, Kauakauaoa. And that all happened the week before the Battle of Gate Park. So the effect of driving that Tairapiti or East Coast War Party out of the area meant that this approach to Tauranga was now sealed off. And it's quite possible that this some of these warriors would have actually turned up and fought at Gate Park if they'd been able to, but they were cut off. So we had the Battle of Gate Park on the 29th of April, and then 7 weeks later, the last battle in this campaign, which was the Battle of Tauranga that we're talking about tonight. So the Battle of Tauranga. That's a sign that used to be there on the old hedge, but that's all been removed now. So after the Battle of Pukihina Hina Gate Park, the British built a really big redoubt on this site. It was actually capable of holding 400 men. It was a really significant redoubt. And then they marched out towards the Wairoa River and destroyed a major pah out there called the Pukariki Pah. They destroyed and burnt that. And then there was another pah nearer to Tipuna, and that was burnt as well. And the plan was to build a redoubt on that site. Now, a redoubt is a dirt fort, or an earthen fort. So, and then a new redoubt was established at Judea. So we know where the Judea Moroni is on Churchill, near Churchill Road. So a new redoubt was established there as well. So what the policy was to consolidate what the government now had, and to try and protect it from attack from Māori from the outside. So I've categorised this as an aggressive stance. They were taking the battle out and they were expanding their sphere of influence. At the same time, there was actually an attempt to broker peace. Some of the neutral chiefs and Mr. Smith, the civil commissioner, the leading government agent in the area, attempted to broker peace. But nothing came of that. But things changed during mid-May. On the 16th of May, General Cameron was called away because his troops were needed in Napier and Whanganui. Tensions were rising there, and he was asked to take his, or he was told to take his troops down there. 1,200 of them left. And that left Colonel Greer back here in Tauranga with 900 men. So he had to change the way he thought about what was going on. He had 500 men at Te Papa, which is down at the mission station, 150 men here on this site, 150 men still up at Makatu, guarding that approach to Tauranga, and 100 at Judea. So he had 900, but he had to spread them across those four different sites. And so that aggressive stance that they had when they had enough men has now changed, and now the government is just going to sit. It's just going to sit and control those four sites and just see what happens. So I'm saying that it was more of a passive defence or a passive stance. Here's what Gate Park looked like at the time. So if you can remember the par itself, when you looked up at the par, it was almost indistinguishable from the horizon. It was just a flimsy fence across the ground. And most of the par was actually underground. Now some people think that this is actually what the par looks like, but it's not. This is the large redoubt that was built on that site almost immediately. And you can see that it sticks right up above the ground, and it was made of sandbags. And this could apparently hold 400 men. And you can see the buildings there. The buildings would have been maybe officers' quarters, but certainly there would have been a contractor there who was responsible. He would have got the contract for supplying food and beer to the troops. And so that would have been part of his organisation there as well. Here's another look at it, just to put a bit of colour and a slightly different angle, so you can see what it looked like at the time. Across New Zealand, some of our small towns actually grew out of redoubts like this. Taupo is one of those. Now, the book that Buddy and I wrote is called Victory at Gate Park? Question mark. And the question mark really is meant to say, okay, Maori won that first battle, but could they continue to fight? Could they win the campaign? Was it in fact, did they actually suffer so many casualties in this battle of Gate Park that they were unable to campaign any further? And it seems to be the case that they took so many casualties, both wounded and killed, that they really didn't have enough people to mount another attack against the British troops. But there seems to have been a large number of other warriors in the area. You can see the point I've got there at the bottom. The people who fought at Tauranga, the 500 who fought at Tauranga, were mainly from out of this district. They were from the east coast, and some were from the Rotorua area, and they were asked to come and join the fighting. There would have been a large number of warriors who had been in the Waikato, who had come out, who were still wanting to take the fight to the British, and there were groups that had come from the east coast that maybe hadn't even gotten the chance to fight yet. There were some who had come down from the Hauraki area, and they wanted to get in. Everyone wanted to have another go at the soldiers. And so quite a complex plan was developed. You remember that the battle plan that Rawa and Puhiraki had here at Gate Park for the Battle of Gate Park was to draw the British out, to attack them, inflict as many casualties as he could, and then possibly then have the opportunity to attack the military camp down at Camp Tupapa. So this is a variation of that, but it's more complex. So the plan was to build another par, have the British come out and attack it, and then simultaneously attack some of those other British positions. Definitely the Gate Par position, the Judea position, and possibly a mountain attack on the Camp Tupapa position at the same time. So it's quite a complex plan, and it's going to need a lot of men to do that. Now, information began to trickle into Colonel Greer and the British command down at Camp Tupapa that there was a battle, that there was a plan afoot to attack the British positions. And this information came in from a variety of sources. There were some Maori living around the Te Papa Peninsula who the British described as friendlies, who were giving information about what was planned. And there were also government officers in Rotorua, in Makatu, and here in Tauranga who started to hear stories that other iwi or other papu had been invited to come into the Tauranga area to fight against the British. And there started to be rumours. At one stage there was a rumour that 600 Waikatos were on their way, and other times there were other rumours. So the British started to get ready, started to prepare, and started to think about the fact that they may be going to be under attack. And to counteract this, they started patrolling. Now, patrolling is when you go out into the countryside looking to see what's going on. And before he left, General Cameron had said to Colonel Greer that he should patrol extensively across the country and across the area and try and detect any activity as soon as it started to happen. Now, one of the things, and the idea would be to attack any new car immediately to not allow it to get developed. From a military point of view, the mistake that the British made here was that they watched Māori build a very strong path in nearly 3 weeks. And then when they attacked it, it was too strong. And so now they are saying to themselves, we will patrol the neighbourhood, and when we see something start, we're going to attack straight away. Now, to help with that, the New Zealand Defence Force cavalry had arrived. Now, cavalry are soldiers on horseback, and they can ride much longer distances, of course, than soldiers on their feet. And the cavalry, one of the things we say about the cavalry is it is the eyes and ears of the army. So their job was to go out and scan the area and look for any activity. And at the same time, another unit arrived, and that was the Waikato Militia. And the Waikato Militia weren't regular soldiers like the British troops. They were had been recruited to fight in the Waikato War. They were farmers and adventurers and bushmen and miners, guys who were used to doing it tough and rough. But the promise to them was that they would get some land when the war was over. So a lot of them are fighting for the possibility of farming. So it's quite significant that they are here also, because that indicates that the government intended to settle on the land and to break it up into farms for these guys. Now, on the afternoon of the 20th of June, Māori was seen moving from the Waimapu River, so that's the river that goes up near Oripi, across towards Tiranga, up near Pai's Park. And Tiranga is, and that was about 3 or 4 kilometres. And there was a large number of Māori, and they were carrying war supplies, they were carrying equipment, they were carrying some prefabricated wooden structures and things like that. They had gone up the river as far as they could in canoes, and then they were going cross country to Tiranga. Now, the cavalry was ranging out every day, and they were going up to 12 miles out to see what was happening, and they just so happened to see them. So they stopped, they watched, it was a 4-man cavalry patrol, they watched what was happening, and they made the assumption of, that they were going to Tiranga or somewhere there, and went back and told their commanders back in Camp Te Papa. And the next morning, Colonel Greer was so confident about this information that he actually marched out with just over 600 men and a field gun just after at 8:30 in the morning. So he believed this information. This is what he had been waiting to see. Now this is Tiranga. Just in case you're not aware of it, this is Pai's Pai Road. This is Joyce Road. And this is Thomas Aquinas College, just here. So this is about 2.5 kilometres up Pai's Pai Road. Now, I just lifted this off the internet, so this blue line is, I think, is probably the reserve, but the battlefield actually extended across here. This was a cart road that took you right towards Grove River, quite a long way. So the Māori warriors, at least 500, had come from over this area here. They'd made their way in the late afternoon, and they'd spent the whole night digging. And they would have been digging frantically, because they knew that the British were out patrolling, and they would have wanted to have been down deep enough and far enough so that they could defend themselves the next morning. Same thing happened when they established this place here at Black Park. So that digging in this area here, there are women there as well as men. On the morning of the 21st, the British troops left Camp Te Papa at 8:30. By about 9:30, they were going past this place here, and by about 10:30, they were in this vicinity. probably somewhere around Bark's Corner, if we all know what that is. Now, there were Maori sentries out that far, and they saw the British coming, the cavalry were in front, and they fired their muskets to give the defenders early warning. So they knew that they were coming at that point. And Rauru Puhiraki, who was in command, or someone, sent Maori skirmishers out to meet them. Now, skirmishers are men who their job would be to fire at them and just slow them down as much as they could. But eventually the British arrived, and by about 10:30, Lieutenant Colonel Greer has arrived in this area here, and he sees what he had been hoping to see. He sees a large number of Maori digging a path. This is exactly what he imagined. And he sent a rider back to Camp Te Papa to bring up the rest of the men that he had, another 200 plus a field gun. So he now has nearly 850 men. But that's going to take them a while to arrive. So they're going to come this way. Now, there's a hill here just opposite Aquinas College, just opposite the entrance. He put the 6-pound gun on that hill there, and he spread his men out across this area here. And they started to fire their muskets at the defenders who were in this area. And this would have stopped them being able to dig, because you can't dig your trenches when you're being fired at. And the 6-pound Armstrong gun would have been firing at them as well. And it would have been like a large shotgun going off. It would have been actually terrifying, and it was firing shrapnel, so it would have been slicing through bodies. It would have been really quite nasty. And so these people here, a lot of them actually decided, there wasn't enough cover. Perhaps some of them decided, I'm not going to die here today, and they disappeared over into the dead ground. But a number of them remained in the pits. A number of them would have had enough cover to remain in the pits. We just have a look here. This is a battle plan of the way it looked. So this is the rifle pits here that they were digging. You can see very steep land on either side. It drops away quite steeply all around here. There's the 6-pound gun that was put up there. And these are skirmishers. So Colonel Greer got established, he threw a group of men across. And if I go back, can you see a slight ridge across here? I think that's probably where they were. He would have put a row of men there, and their job would have been to fire at the Maori warriors and keep their head down. And he also put a group around the side here. So they came right around here, and they were in this area, and they were able to fire up onto the men in the trenches as well. So in a lot of ways, this position was almost surrounded at this stage. So there were 500 defenders. I've talked about the skirmishers and sentries. There was also another group coming from the east, a group of about 500 from the Thames area were in the area. And this may have been the group that was going to attack the gate par position. And they would have heard the firing, and they would have doubled back and come back. And they were yelling out and firing their muskets and coming across from the Oropi area towards Pius Par or towards Sivana. And Colonel Greer, right through this period of time, was watching them and trying to see what they were up to. And Colonel Greer was actually able, because he seized the initiative and he had caught the Maori defenders by surprise, he was able to control the way the battle went. Here's another way of looking at it. I'll go over this side this time. This is a very poor painting, but it does actually show. So there are the trenches there. There's the men in the trenches, or men and some women in the trenches. Here are the skirmishers firing at them across here. Here's the 6-pound gun up here. Here's one group of, in the end, the 43rd Regiment was here, a couple of companies, and the 68th were over here. So you can see that there's a very flat, open battle site. And the disadvantage for the Maori was that it was easy to shoot at them. in Gate Car here, if you remember, Gate Car was higher than the guns, and you couldn't see into the car. You didn't know what was here. Here, they were in a position where they were actually very vulnerable. So they were caught in the open, and they didn't have enough protection, and they didn't have time to put that plan into effect, that plan where they were going to have a coordinated attack. So they're pinned down, and some of them leave. Now, I just want to compare British and Maori, what we call command and coordination. Within a British military group like this that was fighting there, everyone knew who was in charge, and it was a hierarchical structure. And they knew that if this person told you to do something, you went and done it, they did it, otherwise you were going to be punished. And it was very easy for Colonel Greer and the majors under him to control their troops and to tell them where to go on the battlefield. For the Maori here, I think that was very difficult, because you have a whole bunch of different groups of people who have turned up on the day. Some of them have come from far away, some of them are local. They, in a sense, some of them are really just family groups or whānau groups that have come. You know, there's dad and there's his brothers and there's a couple of cousins and and they've come and they're going to fight. But how do you coordinate all of those people? How do you command them? How do you tell those people you're going to do this? Because they may or may not do that. They may or may not want to fight here and die here today. And the same for this group that is coming from the from over the fields. There's no way of signalling to them to tell them how to do things. Nowadays we would use telephones and radios and things like that, but those days there was no way to coordinate on the battlefield. And so I think Rawiri Puhiraki, who was in command of the Maori there, would have had great difficulty marshalling his men and organising a defence. Everything was just happening far too quickly for him. So by 12:30, the extra 200 men had arrived from Te Papa, and the group from over here was getting closer and closer, and Colonel Greer was trying to just sort of coordinate everything. His two majors, Major Shuttleworth and Major Colville from the 68th and the 58th, they were shouting at him, "It's time to go, it's time to go." And the men were shouting, "Come on, let's go, let's go." But Greer was saying, "No, wait. And he was watching this group coming closer, and he was waiting for the reinforcements to arrive. And as soon as he knew the reinforcements had arrived, he declared a charge. And so the charge took place probably from somewhere about here onto the trenches in this area here. And some of you might remember that at Gate Car here, there was a very unusual formation of troops that came in. They were 4 wide and 75 deep, remember? And they snaked their way up the hill. And they got caught in a bottleneck as they came into the path. Here, they have a very wide frontage, so the troops can just charge and they can all hit the Maori defenders at the same time. So they attacked on the wide frontage. The warriors were in the trenches, were in their pits, and they would have been down low, and they would have been trying to fire over the top, keeping their heads down, perhaps even firing like this. And they're using shotguns with two barrels, so they can fire off two, but as soon as they've fired those, they can't do anything more. They have to reload with the ramrods, so they haven't got time. The British had been told just to attack in what they call light order, so they didn't have their packs, they just had their rifles with a musket and a bit of stuff around their belt. And they were told not to fire until they got into the trenches. But the distance they charged was probably about 60 metres, because they had a formula that they would use. They knew if Maori fired at them, they would need a certain period of time to reload, so they could cover 60 metres or something like that. Before they reloaded. So a number of the soldiers were killed as they charged, but very quickly they had got into the trenches. And it would have been a very ferocious, brutal battle. And it was all over very, very quickly. You can see this is just a fanciful drawing, I guess, but it gives a bit of a feel for it. There's someone there being bayoneted. And that was what the way a large number of the Maori were killed, is that they were bayoneted, which is a particularly horrible way to go. And about 68 Maori were killed in and around the trenches within, perhaps within a minute, very, very quickly. They fought back strongly, they had their muskets, they had mainly tomahawks or mere and clubs, but it was a very brutal confrontation and it just happened very, very quickly. But one thing I want to say about the resistance is it's a little bit unusual to face a bayonet charge and not flinch. I have heard one figure that only 2% of groups will face a bayonet charge. Well, in this case, several of the British officers wrote that the Maori warriors stood up and they didn't give their ground and they took it. And the bayonet charge went straight into them and they didn't flinch. And it was a very brave act, I think, to actually withstand that charge. And then the pursuit took place. Some were pursued down over the back of the position, and the infantry chased them, and quite a number more were shot. And apparently the cavalry pursued people for up to 7 miles, whether that was the case or not, but they pursued them further. And another little interesting thing that was commented on by several of the officers is they were surprised that some of the warriors refused to run. They deigned not to run. They just stood up and walked away slowly, some with their heads bowed. They were shot, but they were not going to run. And Greer and Rogan both commented on that in their diaries. Now, when this had all finished, very quickly, there were a number of wounded and a number of prisoners taken. About 47 were taken as prisoners, and most of them were wounded. Some had tried to fight near guard actions, and sort of get in the bush and fire and so on. They were shot, but there were quite a number that were wounded. And they were taken back to Camp Te Papa, and given medical care. There are stories that families were killed here, and some of the local stories, Maitama Waho talk about families being killed. I've only come across information about two women being taken prisoner, and they were both taken back to Camp Te Papa, fed, treated properly, and released the next day. Quite a number of the prisoners were treated. Some had amputations. Some were taken back to Auckland for medical care. So I think that wasn't too bad. As far as Colonel Greer goes, he had already received information that the camp was possibly under attack. So he was out at Tirana with most of his men, and the camp is potentially under attack. He knew that the low tide was at 3:30, and if the attack was going to come, it was possibly across the ford. There was a ford from the Judea side of the Waikaroa estuary across to the mission station. And so he made sure that he went back ahead of the men, he took a force back with him, to be back in the camp by 2:30. He also sent instructions back for the Navy to come off their ships to protect the camp. And the Navy actually put men up the masts of the warships to see if there was anything happening. And it was later reported that indeed there was a party that was preparing to go, come down and attack the camp. But when they heard that of the defeat at Tirana, they turned around and went back. Now, I've got a picture of some handsome men here. I don't mind. I hope this is okay to use. It was in the Herald, so it's in the public domain, but there's some fine-looking gentlemen there, and I see two of them here at the moment. And our dear old friend Perry in the middle there. So I just still think this is an appropriate photograph. So the total number of casualties are probably about 150, 151. Debbie Macaulay has come up with that figure. And we don't know how many were wounded. The British had 13 killed, 39 wounded, which is quite significant. And there were two more Victoria Crosses. So remember I said last week there were 15 Victoria Crosses in the whole New Zealand Wars campaign. Four of them are here in Tauranga. The two here were for rescuing people off the battlefield. These two were for combat in the trenches. But that's not something that is particularly talked about very much. The following day, the burials took place. So during the night, 107 Maori bodies were collected up and laid out in three rows at Tauranga, and the next morning another one was found, so that made 108. There was Maori came up and sat with the bodies overnight. The 43rd Regiment was there as well. And the next morning, on a terrible day, a terrible wet, windy day, Archdeacon Brown buried the 108 people in the trenches that they had dug the day before, or in pits they had dug the day before. 13 soldiers were buried down in the Mission Station Cemetery, alongside their friends who had died at Gate Pahia, and some of the Maori who died from their injuries who were down in the camp were also buried in the Mission Station. There's a monument in the Mission, at the Mission Cemetery, which is really quite interesting, and it's a monument to Rauri Puhiraki, who was the commander of the Maori forces, both here at Gate Pā and at Tauranga, and Inari Toratoa, who was the man who wrote those rules of engagement. Both were killed in the trenches at Tauranga. And on Toratoa's body was found the information about the rules of the engagement, and if they needed any hunger, feed him. That story was on him. Both of those were Christian men. Toratoa had actually, very involved and had was really employed as a Christian catechist, or sort of an unordained priest, and he knew the Mission families very well. Rauri Puhiraki knew Archdeacon Brown very well. Remember I said that they all got on okay before these wars. But in 1870, Rauri Puhiraki's body was dug up. They knew where he was. I've heard two versions of this. Someone might have another version. One is that he was the only one wrapped in a blanket. The other one is that he had been placed across the bodies of the men, so they knew which one he was. Archdeacon Brown would have known where he was buried as well. But he was brought back and buried in the Mission Cemetery as a mark of respect to him. And then in 1914, the 50th anniversary of the battle, this large granite monument was unveiled to him, and it tells his story on the front of it, and it shows him calling on someone, probably Inari Toratoa, to bring water to the dying Colonel Booth at Gate Pā. That's what that picture is of him. And this monument also had on the side, it talks about Inari Toratoa. When this was unveiled, it was said that 1,000 people from the township and Maori and Pākehā came to pay their respects. Now, we've got a little bit of a recent update. One of the things we've never really known is where the trenches were at Gate Pā. Tauranga. You can see that the diagram that I showed you earlier showed them as a straight line across here. But in actual fact, just a few years ago, there was a ground radar survey done, and that shows us some of the rifle pits. And so you can see that they're on a curve, and indeed some of the British accounts at the time said that they were curved, about 200 metres. I think Archdeacon Brown said there were 44 pits. And so that's where they were buried, and that's where the bodies are. This here is an interesting one. It shows, the thing that particularly shows up is iron. So these pink, everything pink is Fe is iron. And so this shows, this will be cannibals and large pieces of shrapnel and things like that all through here. And you can see, the rival pits, and you can see an extrapolation of where the trenches actually went right across Pies Pie Road and into the orchard over there. Now, it's an interesting thing that when a water main was put up Pies Pie Road a few years ago for the Lakes subdivision, they put it up beside Pies Pie Road, so they had to have archaeologists on site to see whether any human remains were discovered. And actually, as far as I know, none were. We know that those bodies will be there, but the water main came up here, but it just must have missed them. And on this side, some of you will know, there's a wooden boardwalk. For archaeological reasons, you can't go down into the ground, so along here the footpath is actually a wooden boardwalk. What saddens me is that the drivers who are driving across, up and down Price Park every day, are actually driving through there and across bodies and not even aware that they are there. So on the 25th of July, there was a surrender peacemaking ceremony, and there was another one in early August. Ngāi Te Rangi and the warriors who were there handed in some old weapons, but essentially said that they wanted the war to come to an end. And the government wanted the war to come to an end as well. And Governor Gray came in August, and he said that he would... I talked last week about the Act, the New Zealand Settlements Act, which meant that the government was going to confiscate land of tribes that are deemed to be in rebellion. Governor Gray said that he was going to confiscate the land, but because of the way that Maori had reacted and behaved towards the British soldiers here, and that's written on the monuments as well, that they didn't mutilate them or torture them, that he would return three-quarters of it. So the original confiscation was 290 or 291,000 acres. That's the green and pink. But eventually 240,000 was returned, but it wasn't necessarily returned to the owners of that land. Mm-hmm. And it was given to other people, other Maori, who sold it almost immediately and made a good profit out of it. Now, I'm not going to go any further than that because there are people here who know that story a lot better than I do. But it was very sad, and what it really meant was that the people who lost most of the land were the Ngāi Tama Waho Hapu, who virtually were made landless as a result of this. Just to orientate you, that circle there, can you see the little orange piece? That's the Te Papa Peninsula. So we're here, just inside that piece. So that's the Anglican Mission, which eventually the Crown took most of as well. And the piece of land that was eventually confiscated between the Waimapu and the Wairoa rivers is this purple piece here, or whatever colour that is. And that is the land that most of Tauranga was built on. So that was all confiscated. And these were forts that were redoubts that were fought, that were built to enforce that confiscation. Now, John talked last week about how quite a few street names in this area are after the Battle of Gate Park. Well, in the new suburb of the Lakes, there are some new street names, and they relate to the Battle of Tauranga. But firstly, I'll just talk about Pies Pie Road. Captain Charles Pye was the commander of the cavalry, and he had a Victoria Cross, by the way, from India. But he was the commander of the cavalry, and when the confiscations took place, there was a line that was drawn, and there was a wooden stockade built just on the site of the Pies Pie Primary School, just to the south of that. And that became known as Pies Pie. And so the road up to that became known as Pies Pie Road. And the whole suburb now is known as Pies Pie. It's named after Major Captain Charles Pye. The main road through the Lakes subdivision, the more recent part of it, is to Roman Memorial Drive, which is, I think, quite nice. And then you can see some of the names that relate to the battle or to the general war, such as Matipu and Pakanga, that are commemorating the battle. And even Robley. Robley was the British officer who was responsible for a lot of the paintings and had married into one of the families. So, I'm just going to leave that there and say, are there any questions or points that people want to make?
Choice of site of
Tauranga. Oh, okay. So the question is, could I comment on the choice of the site for Tauranga? So it wasn't a very good site. The way that, by this stage of Maori warfare, they were choosing sites that either had water or steep drops on either side, and they channeled the attacker to a certain point. And so, if we look at places like Rangiriri and various other sites, they're like that. This site did that, it was steep on both sides, and it channeled the attackers, it channeled the British to come to the trenches. But it was a very small site. But its biggest disadvantage was that it was flat. And so the British soldiers could see it quite clearly, and the gunners could aim into it. And so it wasn't a very good site. The chief Horinatai wrote in one of his memoirs that they weren't happy with the site because it had been chosen by someone else and they just had to stick with it. But yeah, the site was actually not very good. Any other questions?
Did the woman and children escape on the side of the building on the right?
People escaped over the back and down into the gullies. It's very, deceptive country down there, so people would have escaped over there.
Did they let the woman and children go?
I don't have any information on that. I don't know enough about that. The question was, were the women and children allowed to go? We know that some women, two women at least, were captured. I don't have a lot of other information on that, apart from acknowledging that the local stories are that women and children were killed.
I'm fairly new to Tauranga, and for some time I've been bewildered given the scale of the confiscations, why there's not more animosity.
Yeah.
It's coming.
Any other final comments? Mary Wright.
More recently, there's been a large poem on Tauranga.
Yes.
Can you comment on the present status of that land?
I'll get Buddy to do that. So the question was, up until recently there's been a large pole on the site, but that just rotted and fell down. It only lasted a few years. So the question is the status, but that Buddy will talk about that in the next one.
It's a car that not listening to advice to use treatment. And it's been buried in the bun that's there. You know, there's a bun alongside the road. It's in there.
Okay, one more. Yes.
You mentioned last week you've got another book.
Oh.
In process. When can we expect to get out? I've got the first one.
So the question was about another book in process. Yes, I've written another book.
That's the one.
Yeah, well, you can talk to me later.
But
Bunny, we've got the book that we produced in 2019 is being reissued next week, so that's coming out. Yeah.
Right.
Last question, Bunny.
I'm just wondering if you know anything about Archdeacon Brownfeld, who was a man you've been told on who had befriended the Maori and was indeed cultivating and spiritualizing. What did he feel? How could he remain neutral in these situations of the wars?
So the question is, how did Archdeacon Brown feel about this? So Archdeacon Brown had come here to bring Christianity and had been quite successful at that, and had converted a large number of local people to Christianity. I think he loved the community, and he, the missionaries tend to be caught as meat in the sandwich, and this is repeated all around the North Island in this situation. He had buried nearly 200 men at the end of this campaign. His flock, Maori, who he had known all their lives in some cases, and also his countrymen. So I think it broke him, to be honest. I think it destroyed his life's work, and he was very upset. But he wrote a letter to Governor Gray a week after this battle, and he warned Gray that this could carry on, and that the government had to be very careful, and it had to make provision for the widows and the orphans, and it had to sue for peace. Right, well, I'm going to leave it there. Maybe if we have a quick stretch, and then we'll have done. Thanks very much.